Oh man, how do we do this? How does this work?
Hello and welcome to Justice Losers. What do you call this kind of thing again?
Oh God, hello and welcome to Justice Losers, most unqualified podcast talking entertainment news and reviews. Is that what it was?
That's the one.
Namely, movies, TVs, and comics. I'm your host Preston, joined as always by my delightful co-host
Matt.
Wow, that is a big delay for me. This will be fun. Hey, we're back.
We are.
we finished our 1 to 2 month hiatus and came back promptly. It is
exactly just as scheduled.
Yep. It is. That be August? It is August of 2023.
Yep.
This is great. We're the best. And
in the meantime, we met Denis Villeneuve, and he gave us access to a free pre-screening of Dune 2.
That did happen. He was entirely done by August, and was just like, hey, you two guys, watch this, and we did.
But then, of course, we had to respect the review embargo, so we couldn't release this until, or can't release this till March.
Like 9 months. Yeah. So that hiatus took a lot longer than we thought. So as a reminder, Matt moved to Georgia. We are doing this remotely now. We have our little video or our Discord FaceTime going on. FaceTime. Mm-hmm. I sound like a 90-year-old trying to describe technology. And I got married, and then I had the honeymoon, and then I was moving to the city, and just 2 months was just absolutely chaotic for us. And so we were like, we're going to take a little hiatus. And then... Mm-hmm. Matt's new schedule down in Georgia was just chaotic and did not line up with mine super well, and my schedule kind of got a bit harder to work around hobbies with I got a new job, which is not work from home where I can just do all of my hobbies on the side and make time elsewhere. I have to work. I have actual jobs to do now, and so I had a lot of things to do on the side. Couldn't really fit stuff in my schedule. I have a wife now, so, you know, dedicating time for her. Then I got a dog, and that took up a bunch of time. He has currently been demanned, and poor little guy with a cone. So, yeah, just a whole bunch of life stuff has happened for the two of us, and could not... Oh, and also have the editor, Gage, to line up. So any... time that Matt and I found would work, Gage would not have been able to edit for like a week after, which would make the news episode quite obsolete. So we're
and we have some standards to live up to.
Exactly. Yeah, we're back. We don't know if it's, we haven't really discussed if we're going to be able to get back weekly just yet. This is just to get the Dune review, but we think we can pull off weekly. We may have another like a week or two off or something to get schedules aligned.
Yeah, it's unlikely it'll be perfect, but some modicum of consistency at least moving forward. Yeah. Yep, life is hard. Being a grown-up is complicated. Ooh, ooh. I'm happy to be here. Yes, indeed.
Yep.
We're going to...
Yeah. Yep.
We saw Dune 2.
We'll commit to at least one episode a month. I guess two episodes a month.
Let's just talk Dune.
Would be fair. We could try to commit to that. We'll try to do weekly as we can make it work, but just life gets you, doesn't it?
I was wildly impressed.
So,
I think it is very different, not only from the book, but from the first part of the movie.
Welcome back,
from part one, in some interesting ways.
We're going to Dune.
But we're gonna talk about Dune 2. Basically, like the last half hour, not breathing on the edge of my seat, which is, I think, right where I was supposed to be.
You just want to talk spoilers.
And I thoroughly enjoyed it.
I'll do a little chat. I don't know why I said chat. A little chat. Let's just talk Dune. Initial thoughts? Yep. Yep. I entirely agree. There's a lot of differences that, like you mentioned from the book, that were interesting decisions. And I'll get into that a little bit more as we talk about the future of the potential trilogy and how that may play out. But yeah, no, I was the thing. Okay, this is actually kind of weird. I wasn't blown away, mostly because my expectations were literally in the stratosphere, and all of them were slightly exceeded, because it is impossible to exceed excessively the expectations I had for this.
Right. yeah.
It was just an absolutely stunning movie. The music, I'm obsessed with what Hans Zimmer did with this one. I enjoyed what he did with the first, with part one, but the I think it's A Quiet Night Under the Stars, and then Lisan al-Gaib, like those two, which are the same theme, but it's like him, like the romantic part, and then like the, you know, Paul made some decisions part. I feel like that is honestly, all due respect to John Williams, the better version of Across the Stars. Is that what the love theme is in the prequel? And yeah, I feel like that one, this one just hits better. And I think it's because of that use of it elsewhere, because they didn't really use Across the Stars for any other like variant of it.
Right. It very much just was its little self-contained theme.
Yeah.
I'm glad you brought up the score, because I did want to shout out Hans Zimmer for putting in the nice little love theme there. Because this morning I went for a run, and I had the Dune 2 soundtrack as my my listening. And a lot of that soundtrack is very brain-meltingly awesome with a pretty fast rhythm. And so I was kind of booking it. It's pretty hot today, and I was going up some hills, but love theme came in, and I could kind of relax my pace a little bit. I appreciated that.
Yeah. No, it was our friend Carter that was telling me that evidently Hans Zimmer didn't stop writing after the part one. It was like before part two, before part one came out, so they didn't have a green light for part two. He was just writing and writing, and he was like, yeah, I've got it. And then Denis Villeneuve was like, hey, stop writing. So we don't have the second movie yet. And he's like, nah, I'll have it just for you to know what to do with. Which I want to talk about that pairing. So we know that Hans Zimmer works with Christopher Nolan a lot, and Christopher Nolan has a lot of really good movies. I think Hans Zimmer and Denis Villeneuve is the best pairing, because Zimmer can pull off these like grandiose pieces that, like, when you're listening to, give you chills. Like, I literally had goosebumps when listening to the Lisan al-Gaib song, like, in the car. And Christopher Nolan can do big, and he does well. I think Denis Villeneuve has that perfectly down with, like, Blade Runner 2049 and these movies. Just the, you got Christopher Nolan who's saying, like, oh, everything's going to be in IMAX, and, like, that's the theater. And then Denis Villeneuve walks that walk so perfectly. Yeah. And Hans Zimmer's music with it just, like, adds to that scale.
Yeah. Don't take this as a criticism of Christopher Nolan at all, but I think his movies are a little maybe colder in a sense.
More calculated, almost. Like,
yeah.
Especially because he loves doing all the time things, so you kind of have to be.
Right. Yeah, no, they're... every Christopher Nolan movie going as far back as Batman Begins has an awesome score. A lot of those are Zimmer. He's had a couple of great collaborations with Ludwig Göransson recently. I think that's also a pairing that I'm really excited about.
Yeah.
I think a well-deserved Oscar win for both of those gentlemen.
Mm-hmm. Which, but we're gonna call, because it's August. We're totally calling that they're going to win the Oscars in 8 months.
Yep, totally. But no, I see your point exactly. Zimmer he's sort of the grandfather of the new school of this very electronic, heavy, synthesizer heavy, let's make up some really weird sounds and see what we can do, and bringing that to the popular screen in a way that's exciting and vibrant and human. Yeah. And that's a perfect pairing for this big, massive sci-fi soundscape Villeneuve guy.
Yep. Yeah, no, I agree. It's because you agreed with me. We're getting back to the conversation thing. We'll figure it out. I was blown away. I think Villeneuve is my favorite director. And also, like, so here's the thing. I have been getting better at identifying, I've been intentionally trying to learn how to identify the role that different people play. So, like, Dune isn't such a fantastic movie purely because of Denis Villeneuve. He has a lot of the vision, right, and he pulls out a lot of the performances and can drive a lot of it. But, like, the cinematographers pulled off making the movie look the way it did. The editors pulled off making the movie the way it did. Like, the people that he can pull in, he chooses. I guess I don't even really know if he chooses, because there's a lot of producers. Like, do the producers choose who does the editing, or does he get to choose? Like, whatever he's...
I think he does? I think directors get to choose editors and cinematographers, okay, and stuff like that.
The people he surrounds himself with to pull off these kinds of movies is just the right people for what he's doing. And he, I think that's what's making his movies so amazing, is that he knows he has a great eye for the people that can technically pull off what he wants, what his vision is. Again, credit to him for the vision.
That's just, yeah, that's just leadership.
Yeah.
It's, yeah, taking charge, putting the right people in the right places to succeed, and pushing that vision. Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's what you need as a director.
So that's the overview of opinions. That's amazing. I haven't seen many things that good old Timmy Shal is in. I haven't seen Wonka yet. I saw he's in Little Bird, isn't he?
Lady Bird. Yes.
Yes. So I saw him in Lady Bird forever ago.
Yeah. Admittedly, a fairly small role.
Yeah. But I haven't... Well, I feel like he's in something that I absolutely saw, but I'm blanking on what it was.
Did you see Call Me By Your Name?
Nope.
Okay.
But I knew he was in that. Like, so he's like... I've known the types of roles he's been in, and like, I've seen clips of everything. Mm-hmm. The range on that boy... Man, when he would shout things, like in the scene where he like properly takes on like being Muad'Dib Lisan al-Ghaib, was just like chest pumping, just like the command he can put in his voice. I was not really expecting that because like the so I read Dune a while ago, and I've forgotten a lot of it, but I have read Dune Messiah and Children of Dune more recently, and the without spoiling things, him or not in those books is not a very as the way I have kind of internalized his personality is not a very like forceful being. It's a lot more cold and calculating. And so I have not envisioned Paul being the guy standing up and shouting at people, but it worked so well.
Yeah.
And I'm not to say that that's just not me, me not remembering it, that being that way. But so when it was happening, I was like, oh, this is really freaking cool. I like how it's playing out.
I think I'd actually attribute that to a deficiency in the book, that we don't get to see Paul the leader. We're sort of told that he is that person, but we don't actually get to see him in action like that as much. And I think that's kind of a weakness of the second half of the book and Dune Messiah as well. I have read Messiah recently. I'm about a third of the way into Children right now, going through the trilogy leading up to it.
It's real trippy, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah.
had you, I can never remember. Had you read the other two books? I know you've read Dune a lot, but I couldn't remember.
Yeah, this is probably a fourth read through on Dune. I had read Messiah and Children, but it was probably close to 15 years ago at this point, and I didn't remember anything about them.
Gotcha. Had you finished Messiah before you saw Dune 2?
Yes.
Okay. Do you have anything else you want to comment on with Timothée Chalamet? Because I want to talk about some of those differences, because those are really interesting to me, and I've been excited to talk about it with you.
I do, but the differences are the big thing. I do want to say with Chalamet, so I rewatched Dune 1 this week, and it also fantastic. He does a great performance in that. There are very much some moments where he's just sort of teetering on the edge of like the emo chosen one kind of guy.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the performance on the whole works out, and it's great movie. But this movie, there's a couple of scenes the one you pointed out where he's just shouting at the top of his voice at the room full of assembled Fremen leaders. Just the one where he dismounts the sandworm, or has dismounted the sandworm, and he's got his hood up and he's walking through the crowd.
He's just walking.
That presence. Yeah. That screen presence, that voice, that can't be taught. That was fantastic. And I think this is a real step up for him as an actor, just in terms of what he's showing, what he can do. I'm really excited to see more.
Yeah. Do you want to spend a little more time on other actors' notable performances, or do you want to talk about the differences?
Let's talk about the actors as long as we're on this thread.
Okay. Oh, man, that's going to get into differences. I was going to talk about Rebecca.
Yes.
I'll leave her to the side for now. I will say, great performance from Rebecca Ferguson on the thing that's the difference. We'll get into that. We'll talk about it more, but being a villain, it's exactly what that, as far as I can tell where the differences are going, exactly what that character needs to do. Mm-hmm. So I'm very excited for her. I couldn't get past Christopher Walken, to be frank.
Honestly, I did struggle a little bit.
There were some moments, I feel like the confrontation at the very end, I lost Christopher Walken. I saw the Emperor for like a little bit of it, but just it's such a recognizable face and someone who is so like memed for the way he acts and talks.
Right.
It's really hard to get past him.
Yeah. Yeah, I was encountering that issue a little bit too. He's fantastic actor, but he may have been a little miscast in this one.
Florence Pugh was wonderful. I am so excited to see the dynamic between her, Princess Aurelian, and Chani.
Yes.
Like, just there was a one look between the three of them at the end of it.
Great little eye contact. Oh, yeah.
It perfectly personifies their relationship through Dune Messiah, and I love that dynamic.
Yes.
Again, big difference in their dynamic, which we'll get into. Mm-hmm. So she's great. Good old Elvis.
Yeah. Oh my goodness. Speaking of physical performance.
No kidding.
When he walks into that arena.
Yes.
Oh boy.
That arena scene altogether was fantastic. Yep. Did you hear about how they pulled off the black and white? It wasn't just black and white. Do you know what they did?
I don't.
They filmed in infrared.
Whoa. Okay.
Yeah. So there's like, so you can see, and it was, I've been seeing a lot of people talking about how like pulling off that scene was really technically difficult. So filming in infrared, the costume designers were struggling. They had to like remake the costume multiple times with different materials because it just wasn't coming across correctly in the infrared. And like, it's just that scene was amazing at portraying the Black Sun, which I didn't know. I missed that comment in the book what's the planet called?
Giedi Prime
was under a black sun, and so that was really cool to see, and how like when they go back into buildings it goes back to color. Austin Butler, physical performance. I don't see what people on TikTok are talking about where they just heard Elvis. I heard Stellan Skarsgård, which is what he was doing. That was I saw an interview with him where he said that Stellan Skarsgård didn't know that he was going to be mimicking his voice. And so like after they started filming, he was like, "What are you doing my voice?" And he's like, "Yeah." And he pulls it off fantastically.
Yeah.
He credits it to his voice voice coach, which is you need a good voice coach to do something like that.
Yep.
But that was an amazing performance. Just the creepiness and fear-inducing presence he has. Rivals Heath Ledger's Joker.
That was exactly what I thought of. I came out of the movie and I was racking my brains for the last time I'd felt the same way watching a character appear on screen, and I think it was Ledger's Joker.
Absolutely fantastic. Let's see who else is there. Javier Bardem, he didn't have much to do besides the meme of just being like the absolute hype man of Paul.
We'll get into it more when we talk about the differences. I didn't love the way his character was drawn. I think he did exactly what he needed to with it as an actor, and he's a great actor, and when he had some moments to shine, he took them. But I do, that was one of my nitpicks, is I don't love how they handled that character.
Zendaya, thinking back, she had her cool moments, but I feel like she was often just the romantic partner of the main character. I feel that she had moments. I don't know. Watching it again, I may feel different, but I can't quite remember her performance as much as I remember Paul or Butler. I don't know why I used the character name and then the last name of another person, but yeah, thoughts?
I'll push back on that a little bit. I think, again, this is probably more a deficiency with the book than the movie itself. In the book, she's very much just like, I am Chani, bearer of your children, and doesn't get enough to do. And I think that that's actually a big problem with Dune Messiah, the book, is it's supposed to really hinge on the relationship, but we never really feel it. And so I think she did have more to do, both from a romantic angle, which I think was important, and I think will continue to be important moving forward into Messiah. But she got a couple of good action scenes and a couple of like actually being Chani the leader and the fighter, which is not so much in the book, which I think played to her strengths. And I was not blown away necessarily by her the same way I was with Chalamet or Butler in their respective roles. But I think she did great with what she had. And I am excited to see where she goes next.
I will say, biggest standout actor for the entire movie is Anya Taylor-Joy. Looking at the camera.
Spot on casting, but we'll see what she does when she actually gets to do something.
We'll get into that with the differences. I don't know really if that's spot on casting, because how old is she in Children of Dune? 7?
No.
You sure?
Because the kids themselves and Children are 9, and Messiah is set several years after the original. So she's like teenage. She's like preteen or teenage in Dune Messiah, because there's a whole weird subplot where she's like starting to.
I swear she was like 7, like single digits, at least in Messiah.
I don't think so.
I might be wrong. I mean, we also have our computers right here.
This is true.
We have the world's information at our fingertips.
Indeed.
She's 2 to 3. Oh, okay, should be around 15 years at the end in Dune Messiah. All right, you're right. I'll give you that one. Okay,
that's something.
So, yep. You also read it more recently than me, so yeah. I shouldn't have argued that.
I finished it like 2 weeks ago. So,
yep. I think that's pretty much everyone I can think of.
Skarsgård.
Gurney Halleck is good.
Skarsgård, great.
Skarsgård's very good. Gurney Halleck's good. Dave Bautista.
Mm-hmm.
I enjoyed. It's a new angle for him, because he's always the big, beefy, meatcake murder man, except for in 2049. But this time, he's like the big, beefy, meatcake murder man that is not doing well, and he gets stepped on a lot, which I think he did that well, kind of that feeling of being belittled and like shame and stuff like that. That came through from him.
Yeah, I think that works really well, because so one of the great things about Dune the book is how it sort of puts you in the shoes of like, this is what it would be like to be just an incredibly smart human being and how powerful that would be.
Yeah.
Must be nice. And the sort of brute force contest of strength alone is sort of obsolete, I guess, in a world ruled by prescient Kwisatz Haderach and scheming machination people. That was not the greatest turn of phrase, but you get what I'm going with this. So he should feel like very powerful physical performance and compelling presence, but a little bit out of his depth. And I think that's what we got.
Yeah. All right. Differences.
Many differences.
Let's start. I kind of want to talk mainly about the differences that I can see leading into what he's going to change with Dune Messiah. So this is something that I talked about before, a year ago, when we were talking about Dune 2, and then when he was like, hey, we're going to do Dune Messiah. And having read Dune Messiah, it was interesting to me because Messiah is half the end of Paul's story and half the beginning of the kid's story.
Mm.
And mainly his son, who then goes on, because he's the guy for the other trilogy, right? It's just him, like God Emperor of Dune, and
I think so. I haven't read those ones.
Chapter House. Okay, I think it is him, because that's kind of the. Do you remember what he does in Children of Dune towards the end?
No.
Okay, I'll leave it. I'll let you I have that one. It's wacky. Frank Herbert does some drugs. But yeah, so like Dune Messiah is kind of this, it's a transition book
mm-hmm.
between Paul and his kids. And so Dune Messiah, the movie, is going to need to be solely the end of Paul's story.
Right.
Which is going to be interesting because the end of his story is to set up his kids.
Mm-hmm.
And if you don't intend to do his kid's story, how are you going to end Paul's story and not have it feel like light, basically? So it is interesting to see him pulling back on Aaliyah,
mm-hmm.
allowing Paul to be the one that kills Baron Harkonnen.
Mm-hmm.
Aaliyah's just never around. I mean, he sees her, but like she's just kind of talking in the womb,
right?
Which wasn't the deal. She was born and 3 and 4 years old and talking aloud,
right? Which would have been, I think, much less convincing if put to film, for one thing. And yeah, second.
That is something that I was like really interested to see how they would do. And so this is definitely the best way for them to do that.
Mm-hmm.
But you had a second point?
Yeah, well, I was going to say, first, good compromise. And then second, yeah, well, mostly just to agree with you. Paul and to a lesser extent, Chani need to be the focus of Messiah.
Right.
And this, I think, gives them more leverage to do that.
Yeah. They mentioned Abomination once,
mm-hmm.
The queen, or the mother, Jesus Christ, blanking on her name.
Reverend Mother Helen Gaius Bohiam.
Yeah, that one. Calls him an abomination, which is a major aspect in Children of Dune,
mm-hmm.
right? Or is that in Messiah?
It appears in Messiah, but is continued in Children.
Okay, so it's a major part of Children, so whenever I say he with this, it's Denis Villeneuve writing this stuff. They may kind of transplant that onto her in Dune Messiah and let her be... Oh, God, I don't want to get spoiling. It's hard to review something and talk about what's coming up without spoiling what's coming up. Oh, man, I'm really trying to avoid this spoiler. I guess it'll be a lot of learning what it means in Dune Messiah. It's probably not going to be a super mystery.
Right.
Aaliyah being the abomination, like what the actual like real definition that the Bene Gesserit have about the abomination, that is her.
Mm.
So I think they're going to lean into that with Dune Messiah, let her have that arc in Messiah instead of really waiting until Children of Dune, which it's not going to do Children of Dune.
Right.
And then Paul, they may just like not have his kids' story be a proper story. It may just be that like the end of his story is just passing off his empire to his son and just do that and not be like, yeah, his son has all of the memories of everything, his like every like all that stuff, which is an option. And I think it does avoid the trippiest aspect of Duke Leto the second trippy story. God, it's so weird. I'm surprised you don't remember it because it's so weird.
I know what it is, but yeah. I'll get to it in a few days here.
Yep. Chani, her difference.
Mm-hmm.
So in the book, she's all like, yep, I'm good with whatever you want to do. I'm just following you. I'm going to have your kids and this is the thing.
Yep.
And this, she is not pleased with him.
Yes.
That is a stark difference. How do you feel about that?
Again, I think this makes me more excited for Messiah because that has to hinge on the relationship. And so we give them some tension. We give her some things to do as a character. She has to act as a check against, I guess, the worst consequences of his destiny, which is sort of nominally addressed in the books, but I think we're going to get to feel a lot more closely. I think Denis wants to highlight that more closely.
Yes.
And fourth thing, she's a cool character. I'd rather see more of her than that's actually three-dimensional and interesting.
True. Yeah. And to your point, too, about the consequences of his empire, I love this. I saw a picture that was someone edited the covers of the original covers of Dune and Dune Messiah, where the title of Dune is Paul is a bad guy. And then the title of Dune Messiah is In Case I Wasn't Clear. And I saw an interview with Denis who said that Frank Herbert made it very clear that Paul is an anti-hero. He's not a good guy. Mm-hmm. And he wanted to really stay loyal to that vision. And he did that really well, especially with like the way that, back to talking about how Timothy Chalamet is so like commanding on the screen and just fear inducing. The your mother did, like when he was like walking towards that one leader and just like drilling into him. Yep. Which I've seen people talk about online asking if like he had the memories of all the Fremen, but like he didn't. He just knew because of his prescience that if he says this exact thing to this person, he's gonna get exactly what he wants. And just like that total manipulation of an entire planet is not a good guy thing.
No. And he acknowledges that at the beginning and is scared of that, which he's supposed to be.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I think that's one of the things that's most interesting about the whole Dune story and about Paul making his empire is he's like, I have to do this because the alternatives are awful. Mm-hmm. It's kind of actually, I've had this thing that I've been saying anytime time travel in conversation comes up, mm-hmm. I'll always bring up that if backwards time travel ever becomes a possibility, we are in the best possible timeline because people would go back and kill Hitler, and then whatever time thing that does, I guess, is worse because someone went back to stop them from killing Hitler. Like, people, if backward time travel, because if anything ever becomes like is invented, eventually it becomes a very common thing, maybe regulated,
right?
But like, you know, it gets easier to make the thing, it gets easier to do the thing, and then it becomes really common. Yep. So if backward time travel ever becomes a thing, in the future of it being invented, everyone can use it to some, or like a mass amount of people can use it with probably regulations, but regulations can only get you so far. People break laws all the time. Yep. So if there's a law that's like, don't kill Hitler, someone's going to go kill Hitler. So you just have people that are back there with Hitler stopping people from killing Hitler because they know that dying Hitler means worse future. And so like that whole brain or that whole idea that I've had plays into this where Paul's like, dude, me becoming a tyrant and like this, the religious, creating a religious zealot empire is the best possible future is so terrifying. Nope. Imagine seeing all of those futures and being the one person whose responsibility it is to stop all of those from happening.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It would make you an anti-hero.
Yeah. Yeah, sure would. I'd just like to say that I think backwards time travel must never become possible because I refuse to believe that the best possible version of our world is one in which the Emoji movie was released.
that's fair. Someone would have gone back to kill whoever that person was. That TJ Miller, oh, he just starred in it, he didn't write it, did he?
I don't know.
That's fair. I would have said Madam Web, which I love seeing the memes about Madam Web being the new Catwoman. It's great.
See, I think that's kind of good for us as an entertainment culture to have those movies that are just, they're unequivocally bad and they're kind of unapologetic about it.
Yeah.
That's important.
That's not the movie we're talking about. What else? What else changed? Rebecca is not Rebecca. Jessica is not a villain in Dune yet. She's still just the mom. I think if I remember, I mean, you read it more recently. Mm-hmm. By the end of Dune, she's teetering on the line. Like, she still kind of is trying to make him the Kwisatz Haderach. Because as far as I can remember and how I interpret it, She's just trying to save her own ass because she had a male heir.
Mm-hmm.
And so she's trying to prove that he is, in fact, the Kwisatz Haderach. And so she's doing everything in her power to make sure that he does that. Otherwise, maybe she's in for some punishment by the sisterhood or whatever. But that's kind of how I remember slash interpret that whole thing.
Yeah, no, most of her story in Dune is just, I'm going to survive. I was surprised by the villain characterization, but I think it works. And I think it also helps with the trajectory for where they're going.
Yeah. And that's another one of the things that I think they're transposing from Dune Messiah. Because in Dune, Children of Dune, mm-hmm. in Children of Dune, she's just a straight up villain.
Yep.
Like, she's just trying to do her own thing, manipulate Aaliyah, manipulate the children,
yep.
get her own way. And I think that's one of the things that he's changing in order to kind of truncate the trilogy into a different trilogy, which makes a lot of sense. And I do the reasons that the movie gives for her kind of doing this makes sense. And so it felt natural. It didn't feel like, oh, she's a bad guy for the sake of being a bad guy. Because we want to. It's here's what she believes. Here's what she's been doing. Here's her objectives. I'm like, fair enough.
Mm-hmm. It also leans into the fact that becoming a revered mother and suddenly being inundated with 90 generations of experiences mm-hmm. is going to change who you are as a person.
That is true. Yeah.
I don't think you feel that enough in the book. I think it feels like, oh yeah, that's still true. Jessica. She's just kind of hanging out.
Yeah. That was one of the things that, like, watching the movie, I'm like, oh, that makes so much more sense how this impacted them. Cause like in the book, it's like, oh yeah, they drink it and they get the visions and the memories. And I'm like, cool. Got it. And in the movie, I'm like, oh
yeah.
And then
that would mess you up.
Yeah. And I also really appreciate the movie trusting their audience. Mm-hmm. So when she goes through it and then one of the other Fremen women were like, what have we done? She's pregnant. They don't like really explain that doing that with the baby makes the baby do things. It's just, oh God, what have we done? She's pregnant. Next time it comes up, the baby's just talking.
She's just like whispering to her baby.
Yeah. The movie like lets the audience kind of go, oh, it f***ed the baby. Got it.
Yeah. Yeah. Of course we trust Denis to trust his audience and be responsible about that.
Yeah.
Yeah. What was I going to say? I had something useful I was going to tag on the end of that.
I find that highly unlikely.
Oh, not useful, but just an interesting point. In the original, in the Dune Part 1 Gum Jabbar scene, the sound design does a couple of really interesting things, including there is a human scream that is just like layered on itself and distorted to the point where it's just an electronic
really?
Sound. Basically, yeah, Hans Zimmer like custom ordered this for Denis. That same sound appears in the Water of Life scene with Jessica's transformation, which I thought was a fascinating little parallel.
Interesting. Man, that's awesome.
Yep.
I love sound design. The sound design in the music, I've been listening to the Dune 2 soundtrack a lot. Like, there's a lot of just sound, like sand sounds,
yep.
which I love. Like, I mean, it's simple and seems obvious, but just like listening to it with the sand, you like feel like you're on Arrakis. You're like, oh, the sand is blowing.
Mm-hmm.
It's hot. At least on Al Ghaib.
Let me pee my pants so my water can be reclaimed.
that's a thing that was a big difference that I guess Denis Villeneuve learned the lesson from Tenet. In the book, they never take their masks off
because mm-hmm.
that's wasting moisture from the breath. But they're just walking around without their hoods on and without their masks on and everything. Because mm-hmm. Denis Villeneuve was like, I need people to understand the dialogue because the words they're saying, 10% of them aren't real words. So I really just got to make sure people can hear the dialogue.
Yeah. No, it was probably an impossible choice. I do feel overall, though, that part two in some places lacked the same attention to detail that the first one had. It was bigger and had more spectacle and more just brain melting awesomeness. But there were definitely some things where I was like, yeah, okay. Aren't we supposed to wear the still suits? we're still in worm territory, right? You're, you should still be doing the sandwalk here. Yeah. Just some little things like that. Whereas the first one, this is not the movie we're talking about, but I do want to highlight a just a fantastic thing I noticed on the rewatch of the first one, especially after reading the book. So in the book, after Jessica and Paul flee the sack of Arakeen, and Duncan comes to pick them up in the ornithopter, they're basically terrified because they're caught out in the open, but Paul recognizes that it's Duncan by the way he flies in. And that's kind of emphasized, mm-hmm. that Paul picks up on that perception. And they do that in the movie. And if you're paying attention, you can actually sort of feel it. They very pointedly show a couple of shots of Duncan flying overhead in various craft and then coming into land, and they show it like in contrast to other ships, and there is just a slight difference to the movement. It's not something I could necessarily even put my finger on, but you can kind of feel it. And as soon as the ornithopter that comes to pick him up in the movie makes that same sort of little banking movement that they'd emphasized through a couple of iterations before, Paul says, "Oh, it's Duncan." And I loved that little bit of attention, because for one thing, it draws on the book, and for another thing, you sense it. You get to put in those shoes of, this is what it would be like to be this hyper-perceptive Superman, basically.
Yeah. No, one of my favorite scenes from Dune, from the first part, was him, that, like, the chase, or the him flying through during the attack, and just, mm-hmm. like, there's one where he, like, does what feels like a counterintuitive little, like, loop-de-loop in an area to turn, basically, mm-hmm. and, like, it makes a lot of sense when you think about it. Like, with momentum wise, it's a, like, an ornithopter isn't just like a hover ship that could just change on a whim. Like, mm-hmm. it has momentum, and the way the wings and everything works, he would need to kind of do that little like loop de loop around to turn left, basically.
Yep.
Yeah, no, that's interesting. I'll have to go back and take a look for that.
Yeah. To bring it back to part two, as much as I enjoyed it, there weren't any similar moments. There were no moments where I felt that same connection, that same, like, I'm going to pay a lot of attention to the way this particular CGI ship comes into land.
Right. There may have been that, like, maybe we'll watch next time. Because mm-hmm. that's the other thing, too, is you're watching it for the first time. True. You're missing a lot of stuff.
Yeah.
I feel like Fade Rotha's fight style was very consistent. And the fight, oh, man, dude, the fight between Fade and Paul was so good.
Yeah.
Like, you could see the difference in the way that they fight. And just in the book, is it like a quick little, like, a jostle and he beats Fade Rotha, or is it like that actually kind of hard of a fight?
It is. It definitely is a hard fight. He comes pretty close to dying. But because Fade Rotha uses trickery, which is something that I like that they de-emphasized in the movie. So in the book, Fade Rotha has he has his knife, but he also has a poison needle secreted on one of his hips. And so at one point he pins Paul and is like trying to basically thrust his needle into him. Weird little bit of sexual tension there.
Great.
but it is emphasized that it is very close to being a fatal fight for Paul, but it is because of Fade's trickery, which is something that, again, the arena scene in the first one is supposed to show in the book, is supposed to show Fade's cunning because he has the poison on the wrong knife. And the slave is not drugged on his orders because he's going to show off how strong he is. But he has a secret code word that he can say that the slave has been conditioned to freeze upon hearing. And so he's layered in this plan so that he can appear to be the hero. And I kind of like stripping that out. It makes him, I think, more formidable. He loses maybe some of that same element of cunning. But this is supposed to be someone who is Paul's equal, Paul's darker shadow in a sense. That's why we get an actual Gom Jabbar scene with him, which is something that was not touched in the book, which I think is really cool. And so I think by emphasizing that, yeah, no, he is a physical equal for Paul in a knife fight. He's that strong. He's that confident. I think that helps balance out the two. Because in the book, you never, he's again, supposed to be like that dark shadow of Paul. You never really feel that, I think, in the book.
Yeah.
But the movie, you really do.
Yeah. Oh, so they change.
Chani,
I don't think we talked a little bit about her, but we haven't really talked about the kind of the ramifications of what that may look like.
Mm-hmm.
I agree. I do really like the way they changed that, because she was like, hey, I don't want you to become a tyrant. And he's like, I'm not going to become a tyrant. 3 minutes later goes and becomes a tyrant. And she's like, dude,
we talked about this.
We talked about this. You promised. I'm really interested to see where they go with this, because either she still becomes the willing mother of his children, and it kind of just goes back on this whole, like, she's not pleased with him, or maybe he convinces her, or maybe he, like, in part three, they maybe focus in more on that Paul is doing the best possible timeline, and he's only doing this out of necessity for the sake of the galaxy or something, and she gets a little bit more, like, on his side after learning that. Because he hasn't really explained that, like, explicitly. In the books, I believe it's during Dune Messiah that he really talks about, like, I'm balancing on this fine line. This is the only, like, if I deviate from this at all, like, it's the worst. Is that in Dune Messiah more?
Yeah.
Is that still, like, because...
Yeah, he talks...
Because he's, like, because it's the moon, the falling moon, I think, is a recurring imagery in Dune Messiah.
Mm-hmm.
That, like, it's basically like, hey, if I do anything slightly wrong, everyone dies. But now only 6 billion people die. And I wonder if that may be part of the a heavy part of the beginning of Dune Messiah is him tripping on drugs and ruminating on the fact that he is balancing this knife edge.
Yeah, I think it's clearly being set up that he does need to win Chani over, and I think by winning Chani over, win the audience over in some sense. The difficulty I'm having trouble seeing my way around, but I do trust Denis, and I think he's probably got a way around it, is they will have to do a time jump at some point, because we need Aaliyah to be a player, at least.
Yeah, and we need Aaliyah to be at least within 3 sigmas of Anya Taylor-Joy's age.
Yeah.
Because you can't have her be a 9-year-old, because that's not going to make any sense. You're touching some Tobey Maguire age difference there.
Yeah, no. They might be able to get away with still just treating her as a cameo and setting Messiah very soon after part 2. Again, she's born, and then she, like, I don't know, Vision talks to Paul and is the grown-up version of herself or something, but then they can skip the time jump and still have that unresolved tension between Paul and Chani that has to be worked out on screen, instead of doing a big time jump and then apparently there's just been stasis between Chani and Paul for 15 years and then they work things out, or things are worked out off screen. So that might be the solution, is just eliminate the time jump entirely, but it's certainly a difficulty they'll have to work around.
Yeah, no, I agree. I think, to me, the easiest solution, if I were writing this with my years of experience of writing screenplays, you would do the time jump off screen and have offhand comments about the history of Chani and Paul's relationship. I don't know.
Yeah, I don't think I like that.
Well, because also, okay, so here's the thing. At the end of Dune, she's, like, pissing off. Like, Chani's just, like, running. So maybe she just, like, goes to the south for 15 years and then comes back for the time jump, like, after the time jump. And it's like, Paul, what you doing or something? And he's been, like, with Lady or Princess Aurelian for this whole time or something.
I have trouble believing that that would work at all, because we're meant to believe that Paul really wants to be with her and will pursue her, even.
That's true.
Yeah, even if he is wrapped up with actually, you know, being the emperor and all that. Yeah, I can't see a way around it aside from just skipping the time jump entirely.
Yeah. Poor Anya Taylor-Joy.
Yeah. But again, they could totally get around that by doing, like, what they did, just Vision conversations instead, and make that a more prevalent part. She's an infant in the background, but, like, Paul goes into her room and then they just sort of, like, mind meld and
That's true, because, like, he can see the future. So, like, it may just be future he's just, like, reliving future memory conversations he has. That'd be interesting. I need to remember that. I just had a good idea for D&D, for something with D&D. Love when that happens. Yeah, that'll be really interesting. I love the dynamic between Aurelian and Chani and Paul. And I love that, like, I do feel bad for Stilgar in the later books because he's just like trying to keep things together. He's like, guys, he's just like chasing the children around, basically. Just a glorified babysitter.
Yeah. Should we talk a bit about the changes to Stilgar in the movie? Because
sure. Yeah. I honestly don't quite remember him that much. So you will be enlightening me on this.
Okay. Well, I mean, so in the book, he is the great leader. He's wise. He's tactically astute. He's a very compelling character. And I think he does check those boxes in the movie, but he also becomes kind of a focal point for the religious subplot, which I think is blown up much stronger in the movie than in the book.
Yeah, and I will get to that. I want to tick that to
okay.
get touch back.
Because I have something to touch back on that too, but we'll get back to it. And as respect to Stilgar, I think it is important for what Denis was going for to have that religious aspect very strongly emphasized in the story. I think Stilgar was maybe the wrong focal point for that, because I think it weakens his character a little bit to make him just have him be this wide-eyed apostle of Paul. It's like he's supposed to be a very, like, he's relatable. We want to root for him. He's a cool, compelling guy, get stuff done, problem solver kind of guy. And I think we lose some of that in the movie.
Yeah. He's just kind of the surrogate zealot.
Yeah.
The kind of like the
proxy.
That's the word I'm looking for. Yeah. Like he's the leader of the kind of zealotry.
Yep.
Let's talk about the religion thing.
Mm-hmm.
Frank Herbert hates religion.
Mm-hmm.
And I also think Denis Villeneuve does too now. Because it's like the central theme through all of this is how bad religion is, how like manipulative it can be, and how like it's used to gain power for other people, and how messiahs and prophets are just doing it for their own gains and stuff. And it is, boy.
Yeah, it's scathing.
It's something.
So I think even setting aside any like animus that Denis might have against religion or anything in particular, I think it works really well to kind of narrow the focus of the story. One of the great delights of Dune, the book, is it has like six or seven different ways you can read it. You can read it as just a sci-fi coming of age kind of story, or as a discussion of the role of religion in society, or more of a general sociological feudal politics kind of Game of Thrones sort of thing, or as an ecological parable, which is something that was in some sense kind of at the core of what Herbert was going for. That's the kernel of the whole story.
He was an ecologist, if I remember correctly, and that's like,
so not exactly. He was a writer, but he was tasked with writing an article on the use of poverty grasses to basically stem a bunch of dunes near the Oregon coast from blowing across the roads and obscuring the roads.
Gotcha.
And so he was just so fascinated by this idea of how do you control the desert, basically the spread of the sand. Yeah. That he turned it into an 800-page sci-fi epic with five sequels and 23 spin-offs from his son, and now a multi-hundred-million-dollar movie.
Yeah,
I think the ecological aspect is almost entirely tossed out in part two. It was touched.
Oh yeah,
it was touched on in part one briefly. I think in a movie you have to focus, you have to narrow the focus, and so I think choosing the religious aspect to emphasize, I guess, really the danger of Paul and emphasize that. Yeah, no, he is an anti-hero. He's not someone we should necessarily be rooting for. Go ahead.
Oh, I think it will come back. I think that's going to be the major center point of Messiah, like part three, because they've referenced it multiple times, like bringing water to everything. They have now shown that sandworms die in water, and the vision with Aaliyah, she's on a beach. And so they're kind of foreshadowing there being beaches on Dune. And so I think that's going to be kind of his focal point for a chunk of part three, is bringing water back to Dune.
Yeah, I could see it. Yeah, I mean, there certainly were ecological touch points in the movie, but I always felt like they were couched in with the religious aspect of things.
Right.
There's a moment where Paul, I think it's the scene when he's talking to all the Fremen leaders and he says he'll bring you to green paradise or something.
Yeah.
And it feels more like a religious proclamation than the ecological promise of kinds.
Well, I think that's kind of what he's going for, is that it's kind of the theme of the trilogy is religion for a means to an end. And the means to an end is the ecological evolution of the planet, or I guess devolution technically, because it used to have water.
Right.
So it technically evolved into Dune and it is going to devolve back to having water. I think that's another point of it foreshadowing what is to come, mm-hmm. is making the green paradise.
Mm-hmm.
And so now that he has his religious zealotry and is like, he's basically God Emperor, except he's not the God Emperor. He's now Emperor. He's going to be doing that. And maybe that's something that, maybe that's what Chani is going to be doing. Maybe that's kind of her task,
mm-hmm.
while he's trying to rule the Empire with the thousands of planets and putting down revolutions, and the jihad is primarily in Messiah, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, so he's kind of performing his jihad. Meanwhile, Chani and Stilgar are bringing water in. Oh, I don't want to spoil this. Do you think a person who comes back is going to come back? Because I would love that person to come back, because that's one of my favorite parts of Children of Dune.
I think it's probably unavoidable.
Yes. I love getting the inside of a Mentat.
Yeah.
Which also, another thing, justice for Hawat.
Yeah.
It really just...
Again, I understand it. I think there's another fun... I mean, he's the whole Mentat idea is part of a whole fun little undercurrent with like the Butlerian jihad from the deep past and thinking about sci-fi more generally there. If we're going to focus this in and make it more of a religious story, we have to pass off some of those aspects, some of that focus to the Bene Gesserit, which is something that Denis has explicitly talked about after the movie, that he cut Hawat because he needed to make this a Bene Gesserit story.
Right. That's fair. But yeah, I really want them, that character to come back, because I'd love it.
Yep.
Especially if they do a long enough time jump that Anya Taylor-Joy is actually out and about.
Right.
And not just visions. Because then that would absolutely make sense. But then, man, Dune Messiah, part three is going to be like a 3.5 hour long movie. There's so much. If that character comes back, if Anya Taylor-Joy is really there, there's so much that's got to get done.
Yeah.
I do just think that he needs to just go ahead and go with the other book too.
Mm-hmm.
Just make, I mean, I'm sure Warner Brothers would be happy to just keep funneling money in from these.
Yeah, it's a moneymaker for now, I think.
For now, until part three just absolutely flops.
Yeah, unlikely, but Blade Runner 2049 lost more money than most movies have ever lost.
Really?
Yeah. It was like a $300 million movie, and I don't even think it made its budget back, let alone marketing
Good
distribution
Lord.
Costs.
I would not have guessed that in a million years.
Well, it was a very late sequel to a movie that was probably never more than a bit of a cult classic anyway, based on a reasonably hardcore sci-fi book. And it's a great movie, but it's also not a big sci-fi action spectacular necessarily for a lot of it. It's a little more meditative.
Dune 2 isn't really like a action spectacular. It has some action, but
it has a lot more action than the book, which I think is one
That's
of the
true.
Big picture changes that really works, because the book, there's a lot of action that happens off screen, and then a lot of Frank Herbert did some drugs and he wants to tell you about it. It's done on the page. And so I think leading into the action and leading into the relationship building between Chani and Paul are things that, for one thing, just make it a more enjoyable movie, but also set it up better moving forward.
So far, Dune 2 has worldwide made $400 million.
So
just under.
So tracking well, but definitely still needs to keep making money.
Yeah.
Time to go see it again.
Budget. I'm down. I'm trying to convince Kaylin to go see it, but she just doesn't really have much of an interest. Also, our entertainment budget is destroyed mm-hmm. after a birthday month. February is hard for us.
Yep.
I mean, it's August.
Yep. Hannah wants to finish the book first.
That's fair.
But she's only reading papers right now. So during the summer, she's probably going to try to get a good chunk more of Game of Thrones done, and then maybe Dune, like, next year or something. We've started a tradition of New Year's Eve, we'll do a movie double feature. So 2 years ago, it was La La Land and the Batman.
I remember that.
This past year, it was Little Women and Oppenheimer.
Interesting.
Well, she had
Little
seen...
Women and Big Man?
Sort of.
Get
a,
it?
Yeah. Yeah.
Because, oh no, Fat Man.
Fat Boy.
Fat, what? Fat Boy and... Tall?
It's,
I think it's Fat Man and Tall Boy.
I thought one of them was Little Boy. Again, have all the words in for me. So the point of that was we had both seen Barbie over the summer, but she had not seen Oppenheimer yet. So we thought, oh, we could just do a Barbenheimer, but she didn't really want to rewatch Barbie. And so Little Women was also directed by Greta Gerwig, and we both wanted to see it. So we did that in Oppenheimer. Little Women is awesome, by the way. I enjoyed it.
It's been really high on my list.
It was the better half of the pairing.
Little Boy and Fat Man.
Okay.
Have you seen Barbie?
Yes.
Yes. Wait, just making sure.
Yeah. Well.
Not the movie we're talking about.
Yeah. We'll do a catch up after this at some point in the next week or two and talk about all the stuff we've seen. But yeah, the summer was good. We had Spider-Verse, Mission Impossible, Barbie, and Oppenheimer all within a few weeks of each other.
Yeah. All right. What else? Oh, yeah. So I saw it with our friend Carter, who has guested on the host multiple times.
Mm-hmm.
And... I was just telling him all about like the ecology thing with like the sand trout and like mm-hmm. that they're the ones who eat the water so that the sandworms don't die and like the whole ecology. He's like, oh, there's like a whole eco. I'm like, oh yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's a whole appendices at the end written by Liette Kynes. That's just how Dune works.
Yeah. No, that's a big point of it.
Anything else?
I think nothing major.
That's an hour.
Yeah. I think I've hit all the,
about how long it takes us.
I think I've hit all the big things I wanted to say. Oh, this is a little thing, but I got back on Goodreads and reading Dune. I put a review in there and I read some of the other reviews. There are an amazing number of people who read that book and their takeaway was, man, this is just another chosen one, boring coming of age story. Yay, this hero. And he'll win through in the end. And that's all they took away from it.
Jesus.
So credit to Denis. I mean, I think it was an easy choice to make, but I think emphasizing the anti-hero-ness and outright villainry of Paul in some elements was the right thing to do. People don't pay attention sometimes.
Yep. Man, what a good movie. I can't wait to see it again.
Yeah.
I cannot find the music that was playing during Paul's speech. I don't know which song it is because Hans Zimmer writes his music very dynamically. So like, it's hard to like skip through mm-hmm. every single song because you probably won't hear it because it'll be like loud and awesome for 7 seconds and then back to quiet. I gotta figure out what that is.
I'll definitely be listening to the soundtrack a few times between now and the next time I see it, and I'll keep my ears peeled during that scene.
All right, well what do you rate it?
I had it at a firm 9. I do have some issues with it, but I was jazzed coming out of the theater.
Yeah, that's a 9 for me. That's a solid 9. All right.
All right.
Everyone go see it. Go get them up to 500 million.
Yep. Although if you're listening to this and all of these spoilers, you hopefully have seen it, but
that's true. Go watch it again. Do it.
Yes.
All righty. I don't remember how we end this. Oh, you take it away. That's your job.
No, you got to do something first. You got to set me up. Initiate the sequence.
Oh, God. Oh, shalst we? Oh, I completely forgot about that.
We shalst. Thanks, everyone, for listening. You can find this podcast on Spotify, iTunes, iHeartRadio, Podbean, wherever other fine podcasts are sold. You could check us out on Instagram and places like that. I'm not even logged into our Instagram anymore. I'm logged into the my work Instagram.
We have a Twitter that says that we posted one. So hopefully someone will see this.
Yep, that'll be something. Let's see. We're nominally on Facebook. We do have an email, justusloserspod@gmail.com. I'm sure there are some things that could be construed as a Dune 2 Bionicle crossover from the movie, and I would love to hear your theories on that.
Man, I've completely forgotten all of our stupid bits that we do.
They're all coming back now. I'm in my rhythm.
Yep.
Look forward to next week when we're going to do, may not be next week, but next time we get one out, when we're going to do a broad-reaching catch-up on all the stuff we've been up to over the last, gosh, like 8 months. 9 months.
It's been a while.
Yep. A lot of things. I've been reading a lot. I have not been watching very much stuff, but a few things. We'll definitely do some Barbenheimer talk. Should be a good time.
I've been reading a lot of things. Yep. We're in the middle of Harry Potter Order of the Phoenix. I am mostly through, or I'm about halfway through Lord of the Rings, and I am reading The Prince by Machiavelli.
Okay.
So, very dynamic range of books.
That's not quite the collection. I'm in the middle of American Prometheus, which is the book Oppenheimer was based on. I'm reading that with my parents, and then Children of Dune, of course, and also about 15 different chess books.
All right.
All right.
Bye.
Bye.